Do you use the internet? That's almost a laughable question these days. Of course, just about everybody uses the internet. But do you use Facebook? Are you familiar with Facebook? If you're under 40, probably. A little older, like me, maybe not. In fact, it's sort of a love-hate relationship with me. Facebook is extremely useful, but it's also what a good friend of mine calls a time suck. It can basically eat up your entire life, and it also presents other dangers. One of those dangers is that you'll say something on there that you'll really and truly regret. In fact, as Anthony Alanis has figured out, you can say things on Facebook, even things that maybe you don't intend to sound threatening, but that end up being perceived as such, and if you're Anthony Alanis, they end up putting you into jail. To Weekly Constitutional, I'm Stuart Harris, and today we're talking about the internet, Facebook, and true threats.
You're listening to Your Weekly Constitutional, produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's Montpelier. Your host is constitutional law professor Stuart Harris.
Freedom of speech and of the press is protected by the First Amendment to the United States Constitution, and that was an amendment that was largely written by James Madison based upon comments and suggestions submitted by the various ratifying states. It was ultimately adopted and ratified by those same states, the First Amendment was, along with the rest of the Bill of Rights, in 1791. Now, think about that date, 1791. There was no internet then. Yes, I know for you younger folks, it's hard to imagine, but indeed, there was no internet then. So it's really striking how frequently First Amendment issues, specifically press and free speech issues, come up in the internet age. And there is one case currently before the United States Supreme Court, Elonis, that's E-L-O-N-I-S, versus the United States. Recently, the Supreme Court held oral arguments in the fall of 2014 that specifically asks the question, did Mr. Elonis engage in what is commonly called a true threat? And if his lyrics, he's a rapper, he was actually putting rap lyrics on the internet, did his statements constitute something that can be criminalized? And that's a very important question for Mr. Elonis because he's been convicted and he's been sentenced to prison for posting these lyrics on Facebook. And as you might guess, he's challenging that on the basis of the First Amendment. Now, whenever I have a First Amendment issue, I go to my go-to guy, Doug McKechnie.
Well, Stuart, it's great to be with you again.
It is great to be with you as well, but as no doubt people can hear, you're not in the studio today. You are all the way over in Colorado Springs, Colorado.
That's right. This past school year, I joined the law department at the United States Air Force Academy.
I did not even know there was a law department at the United States Air Force Academy.
There is, and we've got a great group of students that we teach in the law department.
So are you teaching
a great group of people.
Undergraduates as well as graduates then?
Just undergraduates.
Well, I'm very glad for you. And of course, we miss you, the Appalachian School of Law. We miss you very much, but certainly wish you well as well and are glad that you're there. But of course, these days, distance doesn't mean what it used to mean. And so via the miracle of Skype, we're now going to talk about your area of interest, of course, the First Amendment, and I believe it has something to do with the internet.
That's right. And before we start, Stuart, as we talked about, I'm at the United States Air Force Academy now, and I have to say that my opinions are my own. Anything I talk about today are certainly my own opinions and not those of the United States Air Force Academy or the United States Air Force or the Department of Defense. So I'm going to be talking about these issues from my own perspective and giving my own opinion.
Now that we've got that out of the way, what are we going to talk about today?
Well, I think one of the interesting things that's going on right now is there's been a lot of reporting about online threats, particularly within the context of many of your listeners have probably heard about Gamergate and some of the threats that have been directed, often misogynistic threats that have been directed towards some females in the gaming industry.
Tell me about that. That sounds terrible.
Yeah, it is, and there are a lot of allegations of people who are making threats that are really terrifying threats, and it is an issue that the Supreme Court is taking up very soon. And your listeners, I'm sure, would be surprised to hear that it is not a settled issue, although the United States and the states within the Republic have recognized the government's ability to punish true threats. the Supreme Court has never really articulated a very coherent, clear analysis or definition of what a true threat is.
Yeah, in fact, let's go back to the beginning on that. The first time I really paid attention to the so-called true threat doctrine was just a few years back when the Supreme Court decided those companion cases in Virginia versus Black.
Mm-hmm.
And if you recall, one of the two cases, they both involved the Virginia statute that criminally prohibited cross-burning.
And, that's right.
Yeah, and cross-burning is, of course, generally, it's symbolic speech of some sort.
It is, and what's interesting is the Supreme Court's jurisprudence or the decisions that they've handed down even go back before the Virginia versus Black case. That was in the early 2000s.
Yeah.
But there was the case in the late 60s called Watts versus the United States. And that was really the first time the Supreme Court wrestled with whether or not speech that sounds like it could be threatening could be punished. And so even before the Virginia versus Black case, we can go back to the late 60s to see that one of the first times the court has struggled with that concept.
Yeah, and it is a tough concept because, of course, speech, whether it's symbolic or whether it's verbal, is very highly protected in the United States pursuant to the speech and press clauses of the First Amendment. And there's a great reluctance to punish it. Yet, on the other hand, we do have some categorical exceptions to that rule. And one of them has certainly, you know, broadly construed it. You can't commit a crime with speech. You can't commit fraud. I mean, simply because it's speech and get away with it. You can't walk into a bank and say, give me all your money. And then when the police arrest you, say, I was just exercising my First Amendment rights. I mean, we make exceptions for certain types of speech. But that idea that simply threatening somebody could subject you to criminal prosecution, it's an interesting and problematic area of law. Okay, so it goes back at least to the 60s.
It goes back to the 60s, and there was a situation that arose out of a protest during the Vietnam War, and a gentleman was overheard saying that if he was forced into the draft and the government forced him to carry a rifle, the first person that he would get in the sights of his rifle was LBJ, who we all know was the president at the time.
Oh boy.
And he was charged with the federal crime of threatening the president.
And I'm going to guess, without having remembering the facts of this case, because it was a conditional threat, was he exonerated?
That was one of the things that the court looked at. And so he was found guilty at the trial level. And so a jury decided that he was guilty and he was convicted, and the Supreme Court reversed that conviction. And the Supreme Court said, in addition to being a conditional threat, if you looked at the context of the threat, it was during a political rally, and the reaction of the listeners to his speech sort of chuckled and clapped. And as you mentioned, it was conditional. The Supreme Court said, if you kind of look at it in the totality of the circumstances, if you look at the whole situation, this really was not the kind of threat that can be punished in light of the First Amendment. The kind of threats that the First Amendment permits to be punished are not these kinds of threats. This is more of a political debate or a political opposition to the president. And yes, crude and maybe offensive, but not the kind of true threat that is permissible to be punished under the First Amendment.
Okay, so we know sort of on a gut level what a true threat is and that it doesn't always exist, even if people say things that could be construed that way. That was, of course, the case in Virginia versus Black, or there were the great thing about that case and the two circumstances there is that they provide such a wonderful teaching moment. It was the Virginia. Do you want to tell about it?
No, sure. It was a Virginia law that prohibited people with the intent to intimidate others, prohibited them from burning a cross in a public place or on property, or on a highway or any sort of property that would be visible to others. And
right.
One of the issues in the case was the law made a presumption, and it required a presumption that anytime someone burns a cross, that the burning of a cross inherently is done with the intent to intimidate. And sort of that was what one of the things that the court was wrestling with was, can we presume that every time someone burns a cross, can we legally presume that it's being done with the intent to intimidate?
And they concluded?
Well, the court said that presumption is not valid under the Constitution, and that all cross burnings could not be presumed to be intimidating. And so, in other words, the court said there might be times that people might be burning a cross, even in light of all of the history with the Ku Klux Klan and using burning cross to intimidate, particularly African Americans. Even in light of all that history, the court said there might be times that people might burn a cross truly to communicate some sort of political message or some other message that would be protected under the First Amendment.
Yep, and they identified exactly that circumstance. And one of the two cases in Virginia versus Black involved a rally of the Ku Klux Klan. It was on private property with permission. But unfortunately, the burning cross was visible from a nearby highway. And when people complained about it, then the perpetrators were arrested. But they defended successfully on First Amendment grounds. They said, look, we're just expressing ideas at a political rally. That's not threatening anybody. And the court agreed.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
The court agreed with them.
That's right. And I think that's one of the very difficult things about the First Amendment is the reality is the First Amendment protects speech that a vast majority of Americans might really disagree with or might find caustic or offensive, but that's one of the things, minority viewpoints is one of the things that the First Amendment, at least from the Supreme Court's perspective over time, that's one of the things that the First Amendment is intended to protect.
Indeed, that sort of speech is called core political speech, and it's one of the most protected types of speech there is. And when people say, but that's so offensive, we should ban it, well, you know, the First Amendment isn't there to protect popular speech. It's there to protect unpopular speech.
Exactly.
Especially the speech that you hate.
Then the problem that comes out of Virginia versus Black, which is a problem that has sort of come full circle and has really just permeated the last 20 years, is what the real takeaway from the Virginia versus Black case was. And so
before we get to that, though, Doug, let's give the other contrasting case.
Sure.
The contrasting case was a cross burning in Virginia by some people who constructed their own little cross out of furniture legs, I think it was, and wrapped it in cloth and soaked it in gasoline. Then they trespassed. They went into the front yard of an African-American family and burned it right in front of their house.
Correct.
That was punishable. In other words, it was exempt from the protections of the First Amendment because the court concluded, based on those facts, that was a true threat. And the threat was, unless you leave, physical harm will come to you.
That's right. And that really is the crux of the issue with regard to what a true threat is. And one of the things that people are required to consider when we're talking about true threats and often speech in general is, what is the context of the speech? And so in the Virginia versus Black case, we've got Ku Klux Klan members burning a cross in a field with the permission of the property owner. What the court considered true sort of core political speech, not necessarily intending to intimidate someone, versus trespassing onto someone's property with the intent to burn a cross in the yard of an African-American family. And that sort of within the context of the situation seems to be more likely to have some sort of intent to intimidate behind it.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm talking with my old buddy Doug McKechnie, late of the Appalachian School of Law, now of the Law Department at the United States Air Force Academy, of all places. We're talking about true threats, the internet, and specifically Facebook. After the break, we will not have our constitutional quiz. I know that's disappointing. I'm sorry. We don't have time for it today, but don't worry. I've got a special treat for you later, and it's a happy thing.
One day, I will kill you. One day, I will kill you. As the cops took me off to jail, I saw you making fun of me.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris. And now let's continue our discussion with Professor Doug McKechnie of the Law Department of the United States Air Force Academy. We're talking about true threats and the internet. And right before the break, we were talking about the seminal case of Virginia versus Black. where the court considered two similar but very importantly different situations. One where the Ku Klux Klan was burning a cross at a rally on private property, and the second case where some local people decided that they didn't like an African-American family, so they trespassed on that family's property and burned a cross in their front yard. Though those are very good examples, and I really do enjoy teaching that case and discussing it, of course, it still doesn't give you a straight-out, pithy definition of the difference between the two. I guess really the only thing we can take from Virginia versus Black is that context matters.
It does, and actually, that's probably the only thing we can take from Virginia versus Black. But one of the problems with Virginia versus Black is, you know, the way that the Supreme Court cut along these two separate situations seems to make sense. One was core political speech. One was probably more likely intended to intimidate. But the language that the court used in discussing what a true threat is resulted in a lot of confusion for the lower courts. And so Justice O'Connor, writing for a plurality of the justices, so not a majority but the most votes, she at one point in time in her decision says that, well, true threats are the kind of statements that a speaker makes when he or she means to communicate an intent to threaten or intends to sort of say words that one would think would be threatening. And so there's this intent idea behind the true threat. But then another part of the decision, she talks about the reality of true threats and the injury that they have on the listener. And so she talks about the idea that true threats and the prohibition of true threats are really focused on protecting the individual from fear. And so in one part of the decision, she talks about how we have to look to the intent of the speaker. But then in another part of the decision, she talks about that the fact that the true threat doctrine and the prohibition on true threats is really focused on protecting individuals. And so that has sort of created this confusion about which perspective or which person's from whose perspective we should be thinking about true threats.
And that can make a huge difference because what I might find intimidating, you might find humorous.
That's true. And what I may say, although I may not intend to threaten you, you may interpret, or 12 jury members may interpret as a reasonable threat or reasonably interpret as a threat.
Okay. And so that part of the law is still a little bit ambiguous, and that sets it up. So now enter the internet, which, of course, already existed in the early 2000s, but lately has become much more of a focus for a lot of these cases. And lots of people are saying lots of very unpleasant things on the internet, often cloaked in anonymity. And some of those things go beyond just mere insults and arguably do constitute these threats. So tell us a little bit about this and about what the court's doing now.
Well, there have been a lot of issues in the news recently with regard to people making threats online. And I think one of the things that probably most people would agree with is that this disembodied nature of the internet really makes it easier to use that form of communication to make comments, maybe caustic, certainly vituperative comments that one might not make in person or even in the sort of physical world. And so I really think the internet has set up a situation where people feel less connected to the words that they may articulate and less connected even to the person who is the reader or the listener of those words. And so as a result, the government is struggling with, and courts are struggling with, how do we determine, how are we going to figure out whether or not certain kinds of speech rise to the level of true threats, particularly in light of the fact the Supreme Court has not given us great guidance in making that determination.
Yep. And I guess the typical scenario is that someone comes to the police and says, hey, look at this printout or look at this screen or this Facebook post or this Twitter post or whatever it is. This person is threatening me. Do something about it. And the police look at it. Of course, all sorts of practical problems of tracking these people down and all the rest of it. But assuming we can get past those technical issues and they know who has done this, the person who posted it almost invariably will say, oh, I didn't mean that, or I was just joking, or I was just expressing anger. how do we then adjudicate these cases? How do we decide whether these are statements protected by the First Amendment or whether they, in fact, are true threats?
And I think that's the government's concern. The government often will say, look, the reality is, whether it's on the internet or otherwise, the reality is that once someone articulates what could be reasonably viewed as a threat, the reaction to the threat, whether it's from the government or from the listener, is going to be the same. So if I say words that one might interpret as a threat, the government may send the police to my house, and they may think that they've got to protect the victim of the threat. The victim becomes very concerned. The person who the threat is directed to may be scared for his or her safety. And so that harm that the true threat is directed, or the harm that results from the true threat, is the same whether the person intended it to be a true threat or was just using hyperbole and sort of joking around or using threatening words as art. And the government often will say, look, we're concerned that if someone says something that reasonably can be construed as a true threat, when that person is arrested and put on trial, he or she will say, no, it's not. I was just joking, or that was my artistic expression of being angry and frustrated, and really I had no intent. And so the government says, no, we can't consider the true intent of the person at the time they make the threats. What we need to consider, at least from the government's argument, what we need to consider is what the reasonable listener would think under the circumstances, whether the reasonable listener would think that the words were in fact a threat.
Man, Doug, I can see both sides of this issue, because on the one side, of course, if somebody were posting all sorts of horrible, threatening things about me or about a member of my family, I'd want that person stopped.
Sure, absolutely.
But on the other hand, the idea that people could look at all the thousands and thousands of things that I've posted and say, I feel threatened by this particular statement that he made, 6 months ago or something, and I don't even remember posting, that certainly is disturbing as well. In fact, I think that we run to the risk of creating something called the chilling effect. If we start holding people responsible for the feelings of anyone out there on the internet, their threatened feelings, then eventually everyone's going to start policing his own speech, and it's going to affect a lot of what would otherwise be protected speech.
I think you're absolutely right, and I think from the perspective of a more protective First Amendment or more speech protective First Amendment, one can certainly imagine a situation where the reasonable person standard, which really in reality is not a standard, it's really what 12 jury members think at the time of the trial, the reasonable person standard might be inconsistent or unpredictable. And that's a concern when we're talking about the Constitution and the First Amendment and the First Amendment's commitment to really encourage and allow more speech and not less. And the government is really stuck with a lot of Supreme Court case law that says any time the government is trying to restrict speech based on its content, it's going to be presumed invalid. And so it's a pretty high hurdle for the government.
It's a huge high hurdle, yeah.
And there is a concern that, as we talked about earlier, one of the things that the First Amendment is set up to do is to protect minority speech, speech that's unpopular and presents viewpoints that the majority disagrees with. And if we consider the true threat doctrine and whether or not something is a threat from the reasonable person perspective, the concern is that when you have 12 jury members deciding what the reasonable person is, they may impart their own reasonable standard, and they may be more likely, if they espouse the majority opinion or viewpoint, they may be more likely to find someone guilty for articulating a minority or unpopular viewpoint. And so that's a concern from a First Amendment constitutional perspective, which might be an argument to really require the jury to get into whether or not the speaker actually intended to convey a true threat. And the jury can consider the context and the actual words. But really, I think that's the question. Should we require the government to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the speaker intended to threaten, although he or she may not have really intended to carry out the threat? should we require that the government prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the threatener or the alleged threatener intended to threaten?
Golly, this is a tough one. I'm wondering, and before we leave this generic discussion, I think we need to point out that hyperbole is often part of political discourse, not just the example in the Watts case that you mentioned back from the 60s, but I seem to recall there was, within the last 10 years, there was a somewhat a notorious statement by, I think it was a Republican, talking about how he'd like to neuter Democrats. Now, I think pretty much everybody understood that to be political hyperbole, but what if someone actually considered that a threat? That he was going to come over and start castrating people. That's a pretty significant threat. And I don't know if we want to impose that sort of burden on speakers. People say stuff like that all the time, whether it's well-considered or ill-considered. People who are in the heat of political battle say stuff like that all the time. I wonder if the balance in this case is tipped by the fact that the internet is, by its very nature, remote. I mean, I can be in California saying this stuff about somebody in New York State, or I can be across town. I'm not face to face with this person.
I think you're right. I think the internet presents a very unique situation with regard to communication and speech and how we are going to interpret lots of different impermissible speech, like vague threat, like true threats. Like obscenity and all sorts of issues that we run into on the internet, and I think that I have always been one to believe that there should not be separate or different speech doctrines. We should create new free speech doctrines because of the internet. We should try to have some concrete doctrine that can be equally applicable on the internet. And speech on the internet versus speech that I might engage with you on the radio, or I might engage with you on the street corner. And I think that we've got to have some consistency whether we're talking about speech on the internet or not. However, I think you're right. I think the internet poses a very unique problem. The reality is that online speakers, they just don't necessarily know who their audience might be. They may be in a little forum that they're talking to their cohorts, the same people they talk to every day, but certainly new people come and go out of those different forums. The internet and speech on the internet certainly can be decontextualized. And so an email that I send to you, Stuart, you could copy and paste a part of that email and forward it on to someone else. People can do screen captures. And there are all sorts of ways that the language and the context that I use on the internet can be cut up, chopped up, and forwarded on or presented to someone else in a different way.
Yeah, and as I said a moment ago, if I'm aware that people are being prosecuted for random things they've posted, I'm going to do a lot of self-policing in the future. And I'm going to be very, very careful about the things I say, and I think everyone else will too, and that's almost the definition of the chilling effect. Okay, now, is there any, I think there's a case called the Alanis case, isn't there? Is it in front of the Supreme Court now?
As a matter of fact, this issue, both from a Supreme Court and legal perspective, is coming to a head, and it seems to be more in the news more lately with regard to things like Gamergate and things of that nature. And so, yeah, there is a Supreme Court case that has brought all of these issues together. It's internet. It's what a true threat is. What's the proper analysis for a true threat? It brought all these things together we've talked about. And it's presented to the Supreme Court, and it will be a decision that will be coming out from the Supreme Court soon.
That's very interesting. You've mentioned Gamergate a couple of times. And so before we get into a discussion of Ilana specifically, what is Gamergate for those who have not heard about it?
So my understanding is that Gamergate really comes out of, it's a sort of an issue that arose within the gaming subculture, the video gaming subculture. And apparently there were some allegations that a independent game maker had a relationship with a video game journalist that resulted in that video game journalist heaping more praise on the video game maker than otherwise was called for or was appropriate. And there was some allegations that that was unethical video game journalism. And what ultimately that resulted in was this female game maker started to receive a lot of threats, a lot of situations where people were going and getting her home phone number, her home address, posting those things online. And a lot of these sort of attacks were misogynistic. And so a lot of them were because she was a female. And there were some allegations from a feminist perspective that the video game subculture was sort of misogynistic subculture. And so there's a lot of that going on in that Gamergate.
Oh, boy. Yeah. And in fact, I understand that women are particularly subject to threats of rape and threats of torture, things that maybe men don't get quite as much. And I guess that was present in that case.
That's correct.
Yeah, pretty rough stuff. And when you add to the mix that people are getting her private information and her physical location and posting that on the internet, that starts looking a lot more like a threat, a true threat.
That's right. And I think that that's one thing that even if you're more on the side of the sort of libertarian First Amendment, we've got to set up as much of a burden as possible for the government to prove a true threat. And so you have to prove intent from the speaker's perspective. I think that that wouldn't necessarily result in no one ever being convicted of a true threat, because I think that if you look at the language, if you look at the sort of totality of all that was said and the context of what was said, certainly no one is ever going to come out and say, I intended to threaten him or her, right? That would be obvious evidence of intent. But there are other ways that we can prove intent in the court system. And indeed, we do it all the time in a lot of criminal contexts. And so the jury would have to look at the sort of circumstantial evidence and all of the evidence the prosecution provides.
Right. And if somebody like this were prosecuted, who'd done these sorts of very specific things, that's a little easier to swallow from a libertarian perspective, because that's not the sort of thing most of us would ever even consider doing. I mean, I wouldn't particularly feel like my speech were chilled if I knew that people were being prosecuted for going and digging up people's private information and posting it online. On the other hand, that's what some abortion protesters have done. They have posted locations of doctors and others they dislike. They've posted it online so that they could have protests in front of their houses.
Sure. And
they consider that core political speech.
That's right. And that's one of the reasons that we need the Supreme Court to articulate the proper test, because the various intermediate appellate federal courts that are struggling with what a true threat is in light of the First Amendment, they're sort of all over the place, right? Some of them require that the government prove intent to threaten on the speaker's behalf. Some of them look at, well, would the reasonable person under the circumstances interpret this as a true threat? And some of them go back all the way to Watts and consider some of the factors that the Watts court considered, like the context and the conditional nature and the reaction of the listeners. And so we've got all these different ways that courts are trying to figure out how to determine what a true threat is and what the government can punish and what the government can't punish. And so that's why we need this case that's in front of the Supreme Court right now to really put some meat on the bones and figure out once and for all a clear doctrine so that the courts know what the government can punish and what it can't punish.
You're listening to your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. We're discussing true threats, the internet, free speech, all sorts of fascinating stuff with my buddy Doug McKechnie, late of the Appalachian School of Law, now of the Law Department at the United States Air Force Academy. After the break, we'll talk about a case currently in front of the United States Supreme Court. Stay tuned. It's your weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harrison. Now it's time to finish up our discussion with Doug McKechnie, all about true threats, the internet, free speech, that good stuff. And after we finish with Doug, don't leave, don't touch that dial. We've got some good news for you from our friends at Montpelier. The case that's currently in front of the Supreme Court is called Ilanis versus United States. Okay, what are the facts in the Ilanis case?
And so the Alanis case is a situation where a man was making posts to Facebook. He was in the middle of a divorce, or he was separating from his wife, and some of the posts were focused on his coworkers, but the most caustic posts, Facebook posts, were focused on his wife. And some of them were some pretty rough language. He was saying things that were rhyming. And so he said, you know, it was really more like art, like rap.
Talk about mixing things up again. Oh, good grief. Of course, if you're writing poetry, that's core First Amendment speech generally.
Absolutely. And that's one thing that a lot of people have pointed to, is that oftentimes throughout history, people have sort of, burned off steam, you know, that sort of internal anger. They've kind of gotten rid of that by using things like poetry, art, and more recently, a lot of music, particularly the litigants in this Alanis case talk about rap music and how it can be construed as threatening in some contexts. But, you know, how do we determine whether or not it's a true threat or otherwise?
Oh, man. And so he said some pretty unpleasant things about his wife. Did he ever actually say, I'm going to kill you or I'm going to harm you?
Well, he said some of those things in sort of uncertain terms, and certainly things that could be construed by perhaps a reasonable listener that he was intending to threaten her. And the courts have all said, look, whether the speaker actually intends to carry out the threat is totally irrelevant. Even the courts that have said you have to prove intent to threaten, it doesn't really matter if he actually intends to carry out the threat. The question is, does he intend to put her sort of in fear, or does the speaker intend the victim to be in fear by using the threat? And so there were certainly language that one might say, wow, this is really not the kind of language that I would use in the context of talking about my anger towards another person. But at the same time, he says, look, this was me sort of working through my issues. Yes, I did it on Facebook. And yes, I used some pretty rough language, but a lot of people use pretty rough language. I mean, you know, the rapper Eminem wrote some rap lyrics, and some of his albums talked about murdering his ex-wife and things of that nature. And so the gentleman in the Alanis case said, it's just the same thing. It's me sort of blowing off steam and using art to really express my feelings. And I didn't intend to threaten her. And the defendant in that case said, the government's got to prove that I actually intended to threaten her and put her in fear of her life.
Yeah. Wasn't there a country song some years ago? I think it might have been by the Dixie Chicks. I seem to recall that they were talking about some fellow named Earl, who was one of their ex-husbands or something, and how they were going to do terrible things to him.
I do recall that song. They talked about killing him and burying his body, I recall. And the gentleman in this Alanis case that's in front of the Supreme Court, in the briefs that the lawyers write, they talk about not only Eminem, but they talk about Bob Dylan, and they talk about other sorts of the blues, lots of blues songs and country songs that use these sorts of this sort of language to express themselves. And this gentleman in the Alanis case tries to analogize his speech via Facebook that way. And the government, the reaction is, well, look, you know, that's art, right? That's Eminem writing an album. But what you're doing is you're posting these things on Facebook in the midst of separating from your wife. And what the government says is that the reasonable person would consider what you're doing a threat, but not necessarily what Eminem is doing as a threat. And so that's really what the fight is about, is do we rely on 12 jury members deciding what the reasonable person would think about the language, or do we require do we require the government to meet a higher burden and prove that he actually intended to threaten, in this particular case, intended to threaten his wife?
Man, this just gets worse and worse the more you talk about it, Doug. This is
Stuart,
a notorious...
Stuart, I find that to be the case every time you and I talk.
You just confuse me. I keep thinking I'm going to come to the point, well, okay, we figured this out, but you just make it muddier and muddier. Okay, I'm going to ask you to look into your very muddy, cracked, messed up crystal ball and give me a prediction. What do you think the court's going to do in this case?
Stuart, you always ask me this question, and I don't know. Am I batting 500? I'm just not sure.
You're doing pretty well. I have a prediction.
I'd like to hear yours. Maybe then I'll go after you, Stuart.
I think they're going to strike down this restriction. I think they're going to say that this is artistic or political, not necessarily political, but this is free speech. And that in this particular circumstance, I don't know all the details, so I might be wrong on this. But
sure.
I think that whatever outcome they have is going to be very speech protective, because this court has been very speech protective.
Yeah, and I think the court could do two things. It could determine that, one thing the court has to decide is what is the legal sort of test going to be, right? Are we going to look at the intent of the speaker, or are we going to look at the reasonable person under the circumstances, the listener? Which perspective are we going to look? So that's a legal question.
I bet they're going to go for the first. I think they're going to pick the intent, because I think that naturally leads to more speech protective outcomes.
And I agree with you. And I think one reason I would say that is I think this court, this Roberts court, has been very speech protective. They have been overwhelmingly protective of speech across the board in every circumstance.
Think about the military funerals case, the Snyder versus Phelps case.
You and I talked about that a couple of years ago.
We talked about that. And you talk about wretched people, the people at the Westboro Baptist Church, are the people that go to military funerals and say that your son is burning in hell. Very, very provocative stuff. And yet the court said all protected. Think of the crush videos that are out there. Apparently some people have a fetish about high heels and killing little chicks, little animals. And those are extremely upsetting and extremely horrible by almost anybody's standards. And yet the court has protected those as well, hasn't it?
I think your inclination and mine, I think we're right, because I think if we talk about this idea of content restriction and the government being able to tell us as citizens what we can and can't say, the Supreme Court, I think, is likely to say, look, if the government's going to be doing that, the government's going to have to prove in court the highest standard that we have in court, which is beyond a reasonable doubt that this speaker intended to threaten someone. And that's the highest burden the government has. And I think that that's what the court is likely to do. On the flip side, the government may still be able to prove that the gentleman that we were talking about and the Gamergate people and whoever else, it doesn't mean that the government can't win. What it means is that the government's going to have to prove that the speaker, in fact, intended to threaten the person. And so it's not like that's the end of the end of the laws that prohibit true threats. And so I think on the First Amendment, I think it's very likely that the Supreme Court's going to be more protective, but that doesn't mean it's the end of the case necessarily. Certainly the case could be sent back down to the trial court and a jury could come back and say, yeah, we think this guy intended to threaten his wife and he could still be found guilty. So,
okay, well, we're going to watch for that. When do you expect a ruling on that one? Are they going to wait to June on that one, or do you think it's going to be earlier?
I don't know. I don't know. The oral arguments are coming up in early December, and so who knows? They may wait till the end.
Yeah, if it's a December argument, I suspect nothing's going to get decided immediately, so we probably won't see anything until this spring. But when it does come out, we'll have to update it, and you'll have to tell us what you think of their decision.
I'd love to come back, Stuart.
Tremendous. Now, are you going to give us a rousing rendition of Off We Go Into the Wild Blue Yonder now?
You know what, Stuart? My singing
Off
voice...
We Go... In, come on.
Into Stuart, I'm going to leave that up to you as the host.
Well, Doug McKechnie, late of the Appalachian School of Law, but now of the United States Air Force Academy, thank you very, very kindly. And do you want to give another disclaimer now, just to make sure you don't get in trouble with the Secretary of Defense?
Sure, Stuart, I appreciate it. You know, I went from one mountain chain to another, and my opinions are my own and not those of the United States Air Force Academy, the United States Air Force, or the Department of Defense.
And we value your opinions and your information, Doug, as always. And thank you very much for your time, and best regards to you and your lovely family and all those lovely little girls of yours.
Thanks, Stuart. It was great to talk to you.
You too. And now it's time for me to deliver on that promise I've been making to you. We have a special treat. It's wonderful news. It's great news. It's fabulous news. And to give it to you is Sean O'Brien, my buddy from Montpelier.
My name is Sean O'Brien. I'm the Executive Vice President and Chief Operating Officer at James Madison's Montpelier.
Extremely impressive, Sean. Very impressive. It's been a while since you've been on the show. So tell folks what you do. What does that fancy title mean?
It means I'm involved in a little bit of everything at Montpelier, from what the visitors interact with to all the stuff behind the scenes.
Tremendous. And from time to time, you get massive amounts of money and you bring it in your pockets over to Montpelier and spend it, right?
If only.
If only. It, well, it actually happened recently.
Well, it did happen, but it was a big team effort, and unfortunately, it didn't show up in a briefcase. It did show up as a check, but we accept
checks.
Did you make
a copy of it and frame the check?
Oh, we have a copy.
I'm sure you do. Yeah. I'm sure you do. Well, what is this check, and how much was it for?
So the big news is that in November of last year, we announced that David Rubenstein, who is a tremendous patriotic philanthropist, is making a $10 million gift to Montpelier over the next 5 years.
$10 million.
$10 million. It's for very specific projects, so it helps us tremendously to tell the story of James Madison and the enslaved community and the entire story of American citizenship and the arc of American history. It doesn't solve every problem that a nonprofit has, but it definitely is an amazing transformational gift for us.
Well, how is it going to transform you?
We're building on things that we've done in the past. You know, Montpelier has been interpreting the story of James Madison for a number of years, and we've worked with tons of donors over the years, all of them incredibly important. And the work that the donors did coming up to November when we made this announcement about David Rubenstein is what made him excited about us. And so, for example, in 2014, we were able to restore the old library, is what we call it,
right,
where James Madison prepared for...
Yeah, for the Constitutional Convention.
You're doing really great at this quiz, by the way.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. It's the Holy of Holies. I mean, if Philadelphia was in some sense the cradle of the Constitution, then the second floor library, the old library at Montpelier, is the womb. That's where it was conceived.
Yes, exactly.
That's where Madison sat and did all of his research. And up until recently, it was more sort of a visitor center place.
It was sort of an empty room where we talked about things,
right,
but you weren't able to sort of visualize Madison there.
Right.
One of our goals in all of the work we do is for people to be able to walk into a space in the mansion. They can see James Madison. They can imagine him standing there or sitting there. And we don't have to go into that part. We can just immediately start talking about the importance of what he did, the political philosophy, the political theory behind.
And that was David Rubenstein's money that did that.
Well, David Rubenstein's money didn't allow us to do the library, but that's one of the things that inspired him, because he saw how we were telling the story, and he understood that Montpelier has wonderful spaces like the library and the dining room and Mr. Madison's room, but that some of the spaces in the house are still relatively sparsely furnished, and some are actually unfurnished. And he really wanted visitors to walk into Montpelier and be blown away by every single room.
Right.
And so he is providing us with $6.5 million to work on the mansion interiors, which will include the upstairs living spaces where James Madison, Dolly Madison's family lived, as well as the cellar spaces where the enslaved community worked to allow the Madisons to have that lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other amazing part of what he's doing, because this is something that's sort of new and a little bit interesting, he's providing us with $3.5 million to reconstruct what we call the South Yard Complex, which is the area immediately adjacent to the mansion where the enslaved community that worked in the house lived and did a lot of the work. So we will, over the next 3 years, reconstruct. We'll continue to do the archaeological research,
right,
and then reconstruct what we think are probably 3 duplexes, a kitchen, and 2 smokehouses where the people who toiled in the house for the benefit of the Madisons.
I'm going to give you a compliment, Sean, and everybody at Montpelier. You have taken on and looked straight in the face this issue of slavery, the great contradiction in our constitutional history. Madison, mm-hmm, and a lot of the other founders, you know, had slaves, and there's just no way around it. And they were aware of the contradiction, and they struggled with it throughout their entire lives, mm-hmm, and they never did resolve it in their generation. And that is something that's extremely important. So as you see this elegant, wonderful mansion, it's nice to be able to look right next to it and see what it took,
right,
to give those people that lifestyle, and that there were other human beings who were enslaved nearby.
And it's fascinating to look at the scale as well, the number of people who had to work to support the white family that owned,
sure,
the property and owned the land there. Is massive. The numbers of people toiling in the slaves and in the house to provide that lifestyle is huge.
Mm-hmm. And right now you've got
to not see that at a lot of places. And now to be able to see it at Montpelier is really fantastic.
Well, a lot of other places. We have to give shout-outs to a number of other historical sites. 20, 30 years ago, when you go visit them, it was almost as if they were trying to avoid the subject.
Yes.
And they would make these sort of apologetic comments and then move quickly on to looking at the China, right, or something else.
Right.
There's really been a change in a lot of different places, and I'm very happy to say that Montpelier has taken a lead in that regard. And so this gift is going to help you to show this much more than you currently do. Right now, you've got sort of these skeletal outlines, but
right.
What you're describing now are going to be actual reconstructions of what we think they looked like, these
right.
slave quarters.
So there will be interpretive spaces in these buildings that will allow us to teach programs to students in one of the duplexes, for example. One of the duplexes will be refitted to look like what it might have looked like when people were living there. Another one might be used for demonstration projects like cooking in the period, things like that. So it'll really improve the visitor experience, and it'll give people a lot more to talk about, a lot more to see when they're on the property. And it will really emphasize the proximity and the nature of the relationship between the Madison family and the enslaved community. So we're very, very, very excited about this. It's actually really fun to see the process.
Mm-hmm.
You can come to Montpelier right now, and archaeologists will be out in the field doing the research that it's going to take to allow us to go to that next step. And then if you come a few months from now, you'll be able to see people actually starting to build some of these structures. And that's one of the fun things about a project like this, is there's a reason to come to Montpelier every month.
Repeatedly.
Yes,
yes, absolutely. And I can attest to that. Years ago, I came and it was still covered with pink stucco.
Yeah.
You know, I saw it then, and I'm seeing every time I go back, there's something different. There's something new to learn. And of course, this gift is absolutely transformative. And that's just very exciting. Very briefly, what else are you going to do with it other than reconstructing the South Yard and all that?
Well, this is what David Rubenstein's gift is for. It's
uh-huh.
for furnishing the mansion, the cellars, and reconstructing the enslaved community South
Yard. And so
Yard
you're looking
area.
For additional gifts from other people.
Correct.
Who are inspired by David Rubenstein.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. I'm inspired by this. I just don't know that I can put as many zeros behind my gift.
Well, yes, most of us don't have that many zeros,
right.
except on the other side of the decimal point.
Yes, yes, exactly. Exactly, Sean. But every little bit helps, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
So how can people join in this? How can they join in and become their own little David Rubenstein and give their own gift?
There's a couple of great things you can do.
Mm-hmm.
One is you can just go to Montpelier.org and you can make a gift online.
Right.
You can mail us a check, of course.
Right.
We also love it when people come and visit us and buy a ticket and then get inspired to give or to shop at the store.
Mm-hmm.
We have a wonderful restaurant now out at Montpelier as well. The
mm-hmm.
Barbecue Exchange is running our restaurant. But you can also participate in what we call public archaeology programs.
Mm-hmm.
So you can sign up and stay at Montpelier for a week, not in the mansion,
mm-hmm.
but in an outbuilding, and be trained by our archaeologist and actually participate in the discovery process. And it's really fantastic. I've spent time out in the field with the archaeologist digging, and there's nothing like, you know, scraping the trowel across the dirt and hitting something and then looking at it and finding out that it's a pig jaw or it's a piece of pottery or something like that. It's really fun. We find really amazing things.
Well, wait, you've done this yourself?
I have.
Okay, so did you ever get any, like, gold doubloons and pirate
treasure?
I
did not find a gold doubloon, but one of our metal detectorists did find us a coin.
So that's the message.
The
come to Montpelier, do the archaeology dig, you'll find pirate treasure.
But you have to do it in our context because it's illegal to metal detect.
Oh, absolutely. No,
this is
all purely for science.
Absolutely.
And so, of course, you know, you probably won't steal any of the doubloons, but it's kind of fun to find them.
Yeah, they're actually more valuable historically than they are in terms of actual value of money.
Right.
Because there's not that much gold in them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I had no idea.
They're smaller than you
would
think.
You learn something every day.
It's not like Pirates of the Caribbean.
Whoa.
They're little.
I thought that was a documentary. Okay, I'm sorry. We're getting off topic here. Well, absolutely. That's absolutely wonderful news. The David Rubenstein gift, $10 million. So for anyone listening, that should be inspiring to come out to see the process and to dig in and maybe contribute a few doubloons of your own.
Absolutely. We would love it.
Sean O'Brien of Montpelier, thank you very much for coming in and telling us all about this wonderful gift.
It's always great to talk to you.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to Sean O'Brien. And thanks to David Rubenstein. And hey, Mr. Rubenstein, you want to give some money to the radio show? Hey, you know where to find us. Our executive producer is Wayne Winkler. Our distribution engineers are Bob Hoffman and Chad Barrett. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our music is by the Watauga Fife and Drum Corps. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable and very nice Jim Blaylock. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment.